Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of The Corner. My name is Zena Wood. I'm the creative producer at Four Bend Corners. And today we're in White Plains, New York. And joining us is Monica Stevenson, our friend and collaborator. She is an incredible still life photographer with so much experience from the fine art side and commercial side. And she does all the things. I'm so glad we could sit down here in New York
and have a chat.
I know, after all this time. Oh, well, actually, I see you a lot. But who thought we'd be sitting in White Plains?
Of all places.
Of all places. Yeah, I'm so glad you could come out. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. And yeah, I'm so excited to just share your story, because when we started working together in Amsterdam for many of the Cody projects, you know, you came to Amsterdam and, you know, I worked here for a very long time. And then the minute you walked in that studio, I was like, New York is in Amsterdam.
That's so funny.
I was so happy. I was like, oh, you filled the room.
That New York energy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I think let's start with like the origin story of, you know, how did you come to doing what you're doing, and like also, you know, the big part that New York played in that?
Well, that's a long and complicated story.
Of course. I
would say kind of once a nerd, always a nerd. And I started my college. I went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. went there as a math and a chemistry major, and then took a class fortuitously called Physics 45. And it was the physics of photography.
That's amazing.
And it opened up every door to me that I could imagine. And I was really enamored with the whole notion. You know, I'd dabbled in photography a little bit, but nothing serious. Yeah. I'd never considered it a career.
Physics 45. It almost sounds like a fitness class.
Yeah, doesn't it? I know, that's funny.
So what exactly did that entail?
It was perfect for me because it was very technical. It was all about how a camera works. I mean, in this day and age, it feels pretty basic, but it was the chemistry of photography. It was the math of why light does what it does. It was, cool. You know, and the nuts and bolts aspect of it really suited where I was at the time. And then I realized, obviously, if I was going to major in photography, I needed to do more of an art kind of background. Mm-hmm. And I transferred up to Ohio University. They had a very, very, very good program. And then I had made a friend in Carolina who was dating the son of a well-known fashion photographer, Albert Watson. And so I trekked over to New York from Ohio and had an interview with him. And he said, yes, you know, I'd love to have you sweep my front doorstep and get breakfast in the morning. So I did that for a long time, but it was a great job. Met a lot of celebrities and learned, you know, all the kind of things that you could never learn in school.
Yeah. Any instances that like stand out off the top of your head?
We photographed some really, really amazing people. Keith Richards stands out. And I remember I used to be fascinated by all the personalities, and I would sit in the corner of the makeup area while everybody was getting groomed or made up. And the makeup artist, we became friends, and you know, Keith is famous for those deep froze in his face.
Okay, yeah.
And she said, you know, Monica, you have to come over and feel Keith's face. I was like, Fran, I can't, like, just go and feel someone's face, you know. But he was a little out of it, a little oblivious to everything. And so I felt his face, and that famous face, it feels famous. But
that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. But let's see what else stands
out. Oh, my goodness.
I met Sigourney Weaver.
Wow.
I met Grace Jones. I met Brooke Shields. You know, it was just great for a young, you know, for someone fresh out of college, it was pretty intense.
Of course, yeah.
It was pretty intense.
And, I mean, did you guys have a very specific process in the studio? You know, like, did they come in and then they, you know, they had to go in hair to hair and makeup? But, like, did you have to, like, get them coffees? Or, like, what was the
It was
the
very,
thing?
Albert ran, I worked for, when I first got to New York, I worked for two people who had very opposing kind of work ethics. Albert ran a studio that was very regimented. Mm. Everything was planned. The light was always the same. Well, I shouldn't say that. That sounds derogatory. But everything was just planned.
Yeah,
there was
yeah.
really not, he was trying his very, very best, given the fact that he had such important people in there all the time to make mistakes and time flaws as diminished as possible.
Exactly.
I would prepare the studio in the morning. I would sweep the sidewalk and I would get breakfast. And I was overall support.
Yes.
And then I worked for a fellow named Chris Callis, and that was on the other side of the world as far as the ethos of how work happened, because he would literally just sort of open the door in the morning and plan some things, because as a photographer you have to, because it's a technical métier. But for Chris, mistakes were what he kind of searched for.
Wow.
Because it was that little and sometimes big imperfection that gave his pictures this incredible life and energy.
Yeah.
Whereas with Albert, it was the cultivated sculptural light and the perfection of the clothes and the perfection of the hair and the makeup. So I think I was really lucky to learn these vastly different schools of
totally.
Aesthetic thought.
So, did you go forward taking one or the other with you, or like obviously adapting it to your own process as well? But did one of them stand out more than the other for your own work?
I've never even thought about that, but I think I took 50% of each.
Wow.
The science brain in me fit very well with Albert's kind of regimented style.
Yeah.
And Chris is a scientist also. He's extremely experimental with his cameras and his lights, but that serendipity and that energy is really nice for me, because I feel the same way. I feel so often it's the mistakes that when they happen that you discover something new.
Yeah, You know what? Now thinking back, because when we shot the, I think it was the Christmas campaign for the Mass Fragrances of Coty. We had that whole shoot day where we had, all the bottles planned or whatever, and I scheduled and then after lunch we do this or whatever. And remember that evening time when we started just playing with the different surfaces?
Because there
was like 45 minutes left and you were like, oh, look what happens when this light does this. And, and then that side of you came out.
Yeah. But it's kind of an indescribable thing, and because that creates an energy. When you have everything planned, yes, you have it planned, but the energy that surrounds the room and that the people bring, because you'll notice that moment that you're talking about, everybody all of a sudden became kind of, positively agitated, and there were lots of smiles and there was lots of laughter, and it was like, let's do this, let's do that. And you just discover. I mean, discovery is what it's all about.
Yeah.
And I love that. I just love that about photography.
Yeah, that's great. And you know what? I love that, my job many times on the set is more like a first AD and, sometimes obviously the producer. But in those moments when I feel people are wanting to be more free and they're wanting to be more experimental, my brain goes, make sure they're not tripping over the lights or like blah, 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 you know what I mean? But I love that marriage of almost like regulation versus freedom that comes out in our job so often.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's really exhilarating for us, as creators.
Yeah. Monica, so you have had Navy beginnings.
I have. I've grown out of being ashamed to say yes, I do. It's something that I will admit to the general public now.
Yeah. Well, that's a journey in and of itself, right?
It was weird. My dad was British, and he was a member of the Royal British Navy. He flew planes in World War II, actually. And he just was enamored with this idea that, because he was in the Navy, that I should be part of the American Navy and it would be a heritage. And so I went to Chapel Hill and was part of the ROTC program, when you look at the course of my career and the way I am, and it just doesn't even seem to make any sense. And it was hilarious because every Wednesday was inspection day, and we were required to show up at noon in our uniforms and line up and have inspection. I can't even believe that I was actually part of this. And at that time, I still rode a bike, I was riding a bike everywhere. I've been riding a bike my whole entire life. So I would stuff my uniform into my backpack because I really didn't want my arty-farty friends to see me in this uniform.
That's so funny.
Because it's a uniform.
Where are we now in the world?
We're in North Carolina.
We're in North Carolina. Okay, yes.
And so at 11:59 and 30 seconds, I would yank my uniform out of my backpack that had been in there for sort of, you know, 6 hours and throw it on. And my hat was all like this and my hair was poking out. I was like sort of the pig pen of the ROTC program.
That's hilarious.
But I don't see very well. I pretty much only have one eye. And the Navy is very, very, the requirements for vision are super strict.
Yeah.
And I could have stayed in the program, but not with a scholarship.
Yeah.
And so I decided I didn't want to go through with it. But there were parts about it that I loved. The ship system, we would take a lot of scientific classes. Ship systems one and ship systems two and great people. So it was a super interesting part of my life, but... definitely not something that most people know about.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. I mean, I find it fascinating. I mean, I've compared the film industry to the military, though. So there are definitely parts of like the systematic stuff, right? Yeah. And the hierarchy and everyone has their job and everyone. Yeah. I love that part of it. Yeah. So, yeah.
But, you know, but back then it was the creativity and individuality weren't really fostered.
Yeah.
You know, and... that's something that as artists and creators we thrive on. So it was, you know, it was a different atmosphere for me for sure.
Yeah, I completely understand. And I mean, I know that then you were in New York in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've mentioned like that felt like such a free space to explore. Mm-hmm. And if you could like share a little bit about that experience as well.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I think everybody thinks that, you know, the time that they go through their youth is probably the best. But the 80s in New York City, I think, were just, you know, inimitable. It was very, very, very creative. Lots of music. We used to go to Danceteria and CBGBs and The World and The Tunnel, all these great places to hear music. And I mean, you know, New York is always creative. But back then, it just seemed sort of super positively just an explosion of creativity everywhere.
And
everywhere.
Yeah, as a still life photographer, what was that like for you?
Well, you know, I had gone to New York in the beginning thinking I was going to be a famous fashion photographer. And I quickly was, you know, came to the realization that that wasn't for me. And what fascinated me about fashion photography were the little details of the clothes, the texture or the makeup or... you know, the way the light hit the beads on something. I hadn't even really thought about being a still life photographer, but I just began to be aware of my appreciation of details.
Yeah.
And
was still life photography even a thing then?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
I mean, still life photography has been something forever.
Yeah.
And, you know, Irving Penn was an amazing still life photographer. There's an incredible history of still life photographers. I think if you don't know, you know, I'd been to school in Ohio, and the whole world of commercial photography was relatively new to me, and it was a genre that I wasn't 100% aware of.
Right.
So I switched my list of photographers that I would call up and focused more on still life photographers, and I learned a ton, and, and then just came to realize that that detail-oriented focus was much more suited to me.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I saw that as well in the retouching process. You know, we did our the shoot days and we had all these assets. And I mean, even on set, you know, you were busy with DIT and basically like speaking to them on how you wanted to order things and where we were putting things. And then that went to the retoucher.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how involved you were with the retouching as well. And like that also seems to me like a very detailed part of the process.
It absolutely is. I mean, now, you know, when I first started shooting still life, I was working with a 4x5 camera and an 8x10 camera, and it trained us to make the lighting and the setup and the way that you rig something, it had to be as perfect as it could be.
Right.
Because there was airbrushing, but there was not the budget for retouching all the time. But now... we shoot with plates, and you can, you know, if you have something that needs six or seven lights, rather than having the six or seven lights, you just sort of move things around and shoot different plates and combine everything. And I love it because it's like painting afterwards, you know, painting during and then painting afterwards.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. Have you felt that there's been like a big jump with software, for instance, that, you know, you have to constantly keep up with? Or is that something that you feel okay with the retoucher doing and you're just sort of keeping up with the language?
I feel that every person involved in the process must be very skilled at what they do. And it's our responsibility to know to some degree the power of what they know, what that can do.
So true.
But it's impossible and it's daunting, the proliferation of all the different softwares and all the different knowledge. I mean, your head can explode.
Yeah, totally.
And I read well and I comprehend well, but I look at the computer monitor and my eyes start to cross and it's just, you kind of have to take a break and just say, okay, I can't know everything.
You can't, exactly.
But it's really stressful. It's really stressful. And you see everyone else doing things what you think are perfectly. And so you think, oh my gosh, that person must know everything. So I have to try to know everything too.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
No. And I think it's more effective for people to just really thrive on what they're doing. And then knowing, like you said, how to speak to the other roles and meet them on that level.
Yeah.
So as the industry has changed, you know, movement has become a very big thing, motion, things just flying and, you know, how have you incorporated that into your work?
So the type of motion photography that really suits me and my personality is stop motion animation. The reason for that is that it is essentially a conglomeration of hundreds of still life photographs. I really like it because we can make the impossible possible. In the same regard that I like to infuse the still life photographs with soul, in a stop motion, because it's a little movie, you have to have characters.
Yeah.
And so lettuce becomes a character, you know, a hard-boiled egg becomes a character. And you can... I think stop motions are in many, many regards inherently funny.
Yeah.
And so you can infuse the wit and the humor more easily because this hard-boiled egg is now the star of the show, you know? And the attention to detail is multiplied 100 times with stop motion. You can't, you know, if you make a mistake, you have to go back.
Yeah, and the process
is just incredibly detailed.
Yes.
We had to make a mandala out of lettuce leaves, pumpkin seeds. I think they were little cubes of squash. And so we made the circular shape of the mandala out of about 60 romaine lettuce leaves.
Oh my goodness.
And the story was that the mandala would rotate and then crumble.
Yeah.
And so all of us had four people on set, you know, somebody was in charge of the seeds, I was in charge of the lettuce, somebody was in charge of the squash, and we would move and make everything rotate. And then the lettuce, I had to tear 60 romaine lettuce leaves into four equal bits sequentially. And it's just, it's insane.
You wanted to do math. You are the math physics person.
But, you know, it's like when it's over, you just take there's this huge, you know, studio-sized sigh of relief that, okay, it's over.
Totally.
And we did it. So anyway,
oh,
it's really fun.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, for sure. Monica, let's talk horses.
Oh, yay, finally.
Finally, right? We had to get out science, and then we were like, okay, yeah, let's go horses.
Bore you with my equine stories.
Oh, equine story sounds lovely. Okay, so, you know, this is like, I would say, a different category. I mean, a horse is a majestic creature that you can't boss around. Or have you found a way, like a sweet spot on how to coordinate with them? And what is the process? Where are these horses? How can I see them? What's happening?
Well, like so many types of photography, the more you know your subject, the more intimate the photographs are going to be. you know.
It really?
Oh, 100%.
Okay, yeah.
And I feel, you know, with my still life photography, I get to know to the extent that you can get to know a sock or a shoe or, you know, you get to know it and then you bring out its soul.
No pun intended.
Oh, my goodness. No pun intended. Completely unintended. And at one point, I was always a horse crazy kid. At one point during my New York career, I think it was in the 90s, I told my father that I was going to go back to vet school to become a veterinarian.
Yeah.
And he said, you're out of your mind because it's going to take you forever and you're not going to enjoy it because your personality is way more flamboyant and, you know, you should be in the art world. And so he said, why don't you photograph horses? So I, bing, the light went off. So I did. I brought a camera called a Diana, which is a little plastic camera.
Mm-hmm.
I brought that to the barn with me on the weekends. And it's a great little camera because you don't have to look through it. It has a plastic lens. And it has a way, because of its utterly low-tech construction, it has a way of allowing your energy. I mean, it sounds kind of trite, but you have to rely on the transference of your soul to get through because there's no technology.
Right.
And I've worked around horses for a really long time, and I'm able to feel, you know, when they're going to do something, you know, what their movements are like, if it's safe, if it's unsafe. I know what the expression in their eyes means, you know, so... it's an easy world for me to navigate around.
Yeah. I think you mentioned like you learned how to ask a horse instead of tell it.
Yeah. I love being around horses mainly because it's so natural and so honest. And the communication is very, very direct. And yes, that thing that I'm riding is 1,200 pounds, and I can't tell it to do anything. I have to ask it to do something.
Exactly.
And they give you what they would want to give you because you ask. And it's kind of a behavior that you bring to life, you know, in your interactions with people, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I was actually thinking that while you were speaking now. It's really nice to transfer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you shoot them in different environments? Is it, have there ever been environments that you've shot them in that were maybe less common, like...
I wanted to do a job for a client with an all-white background and hot sun, and we didn't really have the budget or the crew to bring, you know, lots of white backdrops into the set. So I use Facebook Marketplace and Facebook a lot to search for things.
Like props and...
Props or locations or models. You know, I live in a... I live most of the time down in North Carolina, and things aren't as accessible as they were up here.
Yeah.
So I have to put out a search for them. And so I put out a search for a manure pit that I could shoot a horse in.
Yeah.
And, you know, thinking, I know exactly what I'm saying. I need a manure pit to shoot a horse in. And I got all these answers. We're like, oh, my God, you're going to shoot a horse?
That is hilarious. To
the uninitiated, a manure pit is a three-sided, enormous pit that's usually painted white cinder block. So for photographing, it's fantastic. You know, it's like having a big white set. But, all the people in my town, I was looking for a manure pit to shoot my horse in. So
that is so unfortunate.
I quickly, you know.
You got like banned off Facebook.
I untarnished my reputation as quickly as I possibly could.
As you should.
That's
pretty
funny.
Oh my goodness.
That's pretty funny.
Wow. And you own horses too, right?
I have two, yeah.
Okay, amazing.
Brooklyn and Zoe.
I love it. Brooklyn.
She came with that name too.
Okay, that's meant to be.
Very appropriate.
Yeah, meant to be. So what is it about still life that you enjoy? Because you really enjoy filming life, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is it about still life? The soul, the sock soul.
The soul of the sock.
Yes.
I like being able to bring out the inner life of something. You know, I mean, every single thing has... something, I mean, it, again, it sounds a little odd, but everything's got something to say. Everything has a history. Everything, yeah. And if you study the lines of something, you can. I feel like I like to infuse it with a bit of humanity. You know, a bit of something that we can recognize and a little bit of emotion.
I hear you. It's interesting as well how much we as humans fill in meaning. Mm-hmm. For instance, remember when we were working on the mechs job and we had those, what were those sticks that looked kind of witchy? Do you remember the, it was vanilla.
Oh, it was the curly toes. The curly end of the vanilla looked like a witch's shoe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we knew what they wanted and then we put them in the frame and it completely looked like witchy. I don't know how else to say it.
A potion.
Yeah. And like. Yeah. It would be great for a different shoe.
Yeah,
but
I remember
then
that.
We basically had to. But it's so funny how all of us, with all our different references and everything, all basically were like, "Oh no, that's not it, right?" And I mean, that's also I think something that comes with experience. But but people just watching, looking at the campaign or driving past a billboard would have probably filled in the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's always about being aware of that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, and there's just something really. You know, everybody's mind is different, and I'm a generalist at heart, I think, because I do enjoy shooting things as different as a horse galloping 35 miles an hour and an expensive diamond just, you know, sitting on black velvet. But there's just, you know you have a skill and sitting in front of the set with a pair of tweezers and... you know, working to make perfect composition. For me, it's kind of like a Zen moment. You know, you get into the flow, you get into a zone, and I really enjoy it. Yeah. Making a composition is just really satisfying.
Yeah. And actually, could you elaborate a little bit on the diamond shoots? Because that's something you were doing quite a
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, right? I have and do photograph a lot of fine jewelry. There's a funny little story. I worked for Sotheby's shooting. They opened up a fine, large diamond division a couple years ago. And we photographed all day long a model with a 50-carat diamond. And I mean, it was like a ping pong ball. This thing was huge.
Beautiful.
And she'd had it in different, she'd had it on her head and in her mouth and on her shoulder. And at the end of the day, we had her on a chaise longue and it was nestled in the crook of her back.
Yeah.
And the poor girl had been doing these contorted positions all day long. And she moved, and the diamond fell, and it hit the floor. And the security guard just scooped it up, and he said, you know, okay, the shoot's over. No more shooting. So that was odd.
Literally just like, that's
it. It's done.
That's
it's
it.
Done.
He called wrap.
You disrespected the diamond. The day is over.
So you had to just work with what you had,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, well... Which was the day was done.
It was done. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
It was
okay.
Done.
Good.
It was done.
Well, yeah. I mean, that comes with like security and like I'm sure so many different processes to.
Yeah, it was. It was when the shoots were on location, some like Sotheby's or Tiffany's. They always had their own. If they were at my studio, they would bring usually a retired policeman, and they would come packing with a. You know, with a briefcase with all the jewelry in them. And
wow.
Very often the briefcase was that classic little story that if someone steals it,
with the
it's electric so that he can set off a little electric shock for if someone tries to take the briefcase.
Wow. That's very James Bond.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That is cool, yeah. Are there any other stories like that I mean, this is the thing. We have so many...
Yeah, I was thinking about all the odd things I've shot, and an interesting one was a goose. I had to do a story for Forbes magazine. They had a publication called FYI, which is their lifestyle edition, and they were doing a story on cooking. And so eventually it was about foie gras, but I photographed the goose, and... I can't remember how he even showed up at the studio, but he was huge. He was huge.
Oh, my goodness.
And he got dropped off to the studio. There was no goose wrangler.
Oh, he just got... It's like he got out of cab.
I mean, I wish I could remember... Yeah, I wish I could remember how he got there, but he had no goose wrangler. So it was me and my assistant, Lisa, and this huge goose.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had other things to shoot before we got to him, and... it's not the kind of thing where you just say, okay, go sit in that chair over there and hang out for half an hour while
go
we shoot.
Go to hair and makeup.
So we stuck him in my bathtub.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was in the bathtub, and he was doing the thing that a scared goose would do. And
shame.
Yeah, we went in there and got him about a half an hour later, and there were feathers all over the place, and it was crazy, but
it's so weird.
I know, it was so weird. I wish I could remember again. And I don't even know how he left. You know, I mean, someone had to have come to pick him up, but that was that's very strange. It was a weird day.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, okay. That's a whole other level.
I mean, we made we made fireworks out of squirting Coca-Cola. That was really fun.
Oh, like a tabletop thing?
Well, they were commercials for Coke, mm-hmm. and the whole concept was to make the Coke go in interesting shapes. And a fellow I work with, we filled balloons with Coke, and then we hit them from the back with a bladed, kind of like a bladed daisy.
Yeah.
So that when the Coca-Cola and the balloon exploded, it, you know, made a fire,
awesome.
A firework shape. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's great. Do you feel that, you know, because I feel like everyone we speak to has had obviously a different path. There's so many different ways to get into the different roles in the industry. Is there something that stands out that you would want to maybe give as advice, but not even advice, just something that you'd maybe say was the turning point for you, or was the thing that took you into just this feeling of, I'm in the right place?
The characteristic that has been the most satisfying for me, I mean, first of all, I love what I do, you know, and I think back over the course of my life and the people I've met and how you can see people very, very happy about what they do every day, or they just do it and can't wait till 5 o'clock. I just thank goodness all the time that we are lucky enough to, our entire lives are filled with a career and tasks that we love, you know, and it just makes you inherently happy. You know, you can't be unhappy if you're doing what you love all the time.
Yeah.
And I also think that the part about my photography and the still life photography is it allows me to explore. Mm-hmm. I'm innately curious, sometimes annoyingly so, but it allows me to express that and to exercise it. And, you know, going to a museum is homework, you know, and reading is homework. And I just feel like I've been allowed to be expansive with my mind. And it's been very, you know, it just makes us happy.
Yeah. And I feel like it also adds to growth.
Absolutely.
As a person.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes my husband and I will sit around the dining room table and talk about astronomy, and, you know, we make a lot of people's eyes roll over and they're, you know, roll around. But
in what way?
Well, not everybody wants to talk about astronomy over a glass of wine.
I do. I very much do. So let's go and do that right now.
Oh. I mean, you're asking what kind of advice I would give to someone. I think just stay and exercise your curiosity. You know, always be open to things, always be open to making mistakes, because as I mentioned before, that sometimes making a mistake is an amazing discovery. You know, you come across something that you never knew was there. But it's the curiosity. I think it keeps you youthful.
That's
you know,
for sure.
It makes you an interesting person. You know things that somebody else doesn't know. You can talk about things at cocktail parties. I mean, it's just, you know, curiosity.
Endless.
Curiosity is where it's at.
So I know you have a lot of clients who come to you because you have the fine art photography, you know, background and expertise, and you work in that way, as well as the commercial photography part of you. And could you just tell me how that is like materialized in your life?
What the commercial photography has enabled me to do is approach something sort of with the ultimate kind of professionalism and the ability to see a goal and to be able to make something, or, you know, create something that I'm very happy with it and, you know, satisfied with, but also knowing that it's for someone else and that there's a, you know, that I'm essentially on assignment.
Right.
And when I had my studio on West 26th Street in Manhattan, there was a woman down the hall who was an art consultant. And every time she walked by, and if my door was open, she would see the hallway to my main shooting area lined with framed horse photographs that I'd done. And she thought that was unusual, you know, and she came in one day and saw what we were doing. And we ended up working together quite a lot. And she would have spaces that she needed filled, some most often paintings, but she was a photography aficionado. Mm. So she would come to me with a space that she knew she had to put a photograph in, and she had an idea about the subject matter, and so she would kind of assign me a still life photograph to do. Yeah. And one of them was really interesting. I had to photograph a Chinese book or an arrangement of Chinese books for a men's library in a hotel in Shanghai. Mm. And I love those kind of jobs because they require a lot of research. You know, I mean, I realize it's only one photograph, but it's kind of like prepping for a movie.
Yep.
You know, you can't make this photograph without knowing what you're making. And so I went down to Princeton University and somehow wheedled my way into the Asian library. And it was absolutely fascinating. You know, they all these beautiful, beautiful books with Asian type and beautiful watercolor paintings and leather-bound covers and tassels coming out of the books. And they let me take about 10 or 12 of them home. And I had a little studio at my home at that time, too. And so I spent time making these still lifes of the Chinese books. And I learned a ton about what, I couldn't read a thing, but I learned a ton about what a Chinese book looks like. And then there was another job from her where it was for the Raffles Hotel in Istanbul. And it had to do a jewelry shot, or actually two jewelry shots. They needed 2 7-foot-wide art pieces over the lobby downstairs. Mm-hmm. And I had to make sort of a cornucopia of pearls and crystals and that sort of thing. That was really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's and then one of the most interesting ones was doing a series of 3 constructions for the Embassy of Qatar up in Washington, D.C. And I worked with a photographer who was from Qatar who shot landscapes, and she provided the landscapes, and then I provided all the materials for the still lifes. We ended up shooting things that were kind of endemic to Qatar. Their national mineral is selenite, and so I got a big piece of selenite, and we just made these beautiful arrangements, and so it was a nice collaboration to work with someone from over there to do something for the embassy.
For sure. And I mean, adding that step of research, it feels like it just adds so much richness to the whole thing.
Yeah, it's very stimulating.
Yeah. And I've noticed, you know, with your beauty work as well, that you also like to research things to know what it is, what it feels like, what it smells like. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you bring into your process with commercial beauty campaigns as well?
Yeah, and with makeup and beauty photography and, you know, doing the textures, you're often making little artworks. You know, we call it smears. And it's nice to have in the back of your mind a history of art and a knowledge of, you know, color theory and all that sort of thing. And so and I'm working with a stylist who throws things down on the set, and you just end up making beautiful little artworks with the cosmetics.
Yeah, exactly. And is that how Manolo Blahnik came about?
Oh, my goodness.
Or was that more spur of the moment?
How did that one happen? I got asked. I am absolutely fascinated by shooting horses, fast-moving things. And in the still life world, it ends up being shooting water and liquids. And it's very technical. It's really serendipitous. It's an awful lot of fun. But I got a job shooting paint. And I'd never thrown paint before. And so we did a test day in the studio. And what we do is just encase the whole studio in drop cloths, in plastic drop cloths, and mix some interesting colors of paint. And my assistant at the time, Mike, he had on the side of the set a couple of plexiglass cubes filled with paint, and he would throw them in the air, and at the apex of the arc, we would snap the camera.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, because you literally never, ever, ever know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And at one throw, Mike threw it, the camera snapped, the lights snapped, and, you know, you see the after image in your eye, and we no one had looked at the monitor yet, and we all kind of looked around at each other. We said, was that a shoe? And we look at the monitor, we're like, oh my God, it was really a shoe, because there in all its purple, shiny paint glory was a high-heeled shoe.
Wait, where did it come from?
Mike's little plexiglass cube.
There was a shoe inside?
No, it was literally a one in a 5 trillion chance. But he threw the paint, and it was the shape of a shoe.
That's unbelievable. Yeah.
And I remember sending it had a bit of a clumpy toe and a thick heel. So I sent to my retoucher a few photographs of a Manolo Blahnik shoe. And yeah. So I said, you know, you just need to pare the heel down a little bit and narrow the toe a bit so that it looks like a bit more like an elegant stiletto.
Yeah, exactly.
But it really happened. So I turned to Mike after that one. I said, okay, well, now you have to throw a handbag.
So just keep throwing
just
products.
Keep throwing, jewelry next.
And that won an award, right?
It's won a couple of awards.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I was really lucky because it forged my relationship with Epson. I work with Epson Printing. And they saw that hang up in a camera store in New York and were struck by it. So
yeah.
That was the beginning of a very fruitful relationship with them.
Yeah, wow. You know, this podcast, we're covering shoes, soles of shoes, socks.
It's true. We've talked about a lot of shoes, haven't we?
Well, Monica, it was absolutely lovely chatting with you.
Thank you.
I'm so excited and privileged to work with you again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.